Policy, April 4th, 2005. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 771. And Michael Helbeck, Becky Child, and Bob Nickel, just briefly, because I sort of know what we're going to do with this. And please limit your comments to a couple of minutes apiece, and move forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I've already provided written testimony. I mostly wanted to come back today since there was a second chance for a hearing to repeat my full and complete support for the concept and my interest in seeing this position established within my office. And I was very moved by the testimony last week by a variety of people who talked about the benefits of this kind of a position, and so I won't repeat any of that, but I just want to reiterate my support for Senate Bill 771.
May I ask a question? Mr. Nickel, and you still think that you have a position in your organization that this could fit into? So as far as you're concerned, this would not be a fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris said that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair, fellow senators. My name is Becky Child, and I live in Portland, Oregon. Last week you heard about why Senate Bill 771 is needed. We came to you stating there was no fiscal impact associated with this bill. Well, we were wrong, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about why we were wrong. When Bob Nickel was made the senior administrator of OMAS, he met with a group of consumer survivors to ask for our input. Prior to Bob's hiring as the senior administrator for OMAS, no other administrator had met before with consumer survivors to talk about the things that concern us regarding the services we receive or how we are treated in the system that's supposed to help us, but which all too often traumatizes us. It was the first time that we were given a forum where we could speak for ourselves and that we didn't have well-meaning individuals speaking for us or on our behalf, and boy, did we speak. At that first meeting nearly 2 years ago, I commented that it would be nice if we had a regular forum where the OMAS administration could get our feedback about what matters to us on a regular basis.
Nope.
I said OMAS meets regularly with the community mental health directors, the mental health organization directors, the Planning and Management Advisory Council, but they never have a forum that is for us. To my pleasant surprise, Bob stated that he was willing to meet with us on a regular basis. I know you all can't imagine this, but the group of individuals that met with Bob Nickel that day were a group of individuals who have passionate and somewhat, frequently conflicting beliefs, and some of our discussions could become heated at times. Consumer survivors have frequently said to Bob Nickel in one form or another, please give us money to support consumer-directed services and have an expanded voice in the system. Bob Nickel has said, unfortunately, I don't have money at this time to increase consumer-directed services, but here are some other resources that are available to you. At one of the subsequent meetings, consumer survivors asked Bob once again for money to support consumer-directed services, and again, Bob made suggestions of other avenues to approach, and then he suggested something else. If we wanted more consumer-directed services and a larger voice in the system, we needed to go to the legislature. Well, here we are. But we didn't come asking you for money directly. We came asking you to support us in our efforts to transform mental health services and direct DHS to develop and promote a policy of self-determination and improve the redistribution of resources currently allocated to OMAS. Rather naively, we didn't see this as having a fiscal impact. We saw this as a business manager looking at the overall performance of his office, seeing where there was a lot of hard work taking place and rewarding that hard work by redistributing current resources available to him. The agenda for the Consumer Survivors Council is always packed. We had discussed concerns, ideas, and made suggestions and recommendations. Our next meeting, the Consumer Survivor Council, is April 13th. We invite you to come and observe the work we're doing. At our April meeting, Leola McKenzie from the Chief Justice's office will be there continuing dialogue about our concerns regarding mental health courts. Norm Clark from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training will be there to discuss concerns of how police officers are trained to interact with people experiencing mental health issues. Advisory councils are critical to bring together a wide range of perspectives about issues that affect the people who use the services. Meetings help educate the administration about issues and concerns that are important to us, but the advisory council meetings by themselves do not offer a touch point for consumer survivors. An Office of Consumer Survivor Affairs will allow DHS and OMAS to have an effective barometer for the peer-delivered services currently available in a few communities and to create a fidelity and quality standards of what peer-operated services should look like. In addition, it provides DHS and OMAS with an in-house resource for feedback about policy rules and other matters and their impact upon consumers, survivors around the state. Many consumer survivors have had the unpleasant experience of being the person with the unanticipated effect of a policy and a rule change. It's not a pleasant experience and can create a lot of havoc and stress needlessly. Having someone who can provide feedback to OMAS as to what the unanticipated effects of a policy change might be will help OMAS create more effective policies. The part of the bill that discusses creating an ombudsman's position specifically stated that we would wait until funding was available to create that position, and that it was something we felt was strongly needed in order to help us transform our mental health system and create outcomes of people being able to have meaningful lives. There's a lot of hard work involved in transforming a monolithic dysfunctional system, and it requires teamwork from everyone: service providers and administrators, the customers the system was designed to serve, and the people who have stewardship for the wise use of public dollars. We hope that you will support the ability of consumer survivors to have a critically needed voice in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services by allowing DHS and OMAS to redistribute current resources. Through approving this action, we hope you will remove the fiscal impact and referral to Ways and Means so that this essential legislation can move forward. It's time to give consumer survivors an equal voice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Liebichuk, and I come to you as a private citizen, as a person who has received mental health services, as a person who sits on the consumer task force that works towards developing the concepts for this bill, and as a person who sits on the consumer council that advises Bob Nickel at OMAS. I said earlier that I'm somebody who's received mental health services. That's true. I cost the state in excess of $250,000, lots of it being Medicaid dollars. However, $250,000 or more went into my care between 1976, when I was diagnosed with paranoid-type schizophrenia, to 1987, when I started entering my recovery. I was hospitalized 17 times during those years between 1976 and 1987. 10 of those hospitalizations were in the state hospital system. Subsequent to 1987, I've been hospitalized 3 times at a very minimal cost to the state and to the public. What changed? I got involved in what was called the Mind Empowered Incorporated, a consumer-run program, a drop-in center that had case management teams. I was its first president of the board, and my life changed at that point. The changes that occurred were mostly internal, but also they were facilitated by support from peers. The primary internal change was that I started seeing myself not as somebody who has a life to be dictated by the mental health system, and thus the responsibility lies within the hands of the mental health system for what occurs in my life, but rather I saw myself as an autonomous individual who has to accept responsibility for his own decisions and move on with his life, and I did that. In 2004, I paid over $7,000 in state and federal taxes. I'm no longer costing the system money. I'm giving back. I'm giving back in meaningful ways through participating in policy changes, through participating in service delivery changes, by participating in testimony here. The changes that occurred were made possible by a concept of peers helping peers, and that's what this bill is all about. The Office of Consumer Affairs, if instituted, would provide for consumer-operated services to work with each other to learn how to better provide services. The office itself would provide technical assistance to these programs. These programs would then help other people recover. The long-term gains to the individual is incredible, and it cannot be measured. The gains to the taxpayer can. We would see a reduced need for service dollars as people recover to become self-sustaining individuals capable of not only holding a job, but paying taxes. Most importantly, we'd see people having full and meaningful lives participating in the community. We've seen this time and time again, at least I have in my life, in the lives of people who participated in peer-to-peer service delivery and in advocacy as persons who have received services. I encourage the passage of this bill, and I thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you so much. I have really wanted to rescind the referral to Ways and Means, and I have talked with Legislative Physical. I've talked to Mr. Nickel. I've talked to the President's office, and there really is no way. But the reason I mainly wanted to rescind the referral is so that we could have a debate on the floor of the Senate, because the more that we talk about mental health, it's going to help remove the stigma to so many many of our mental health consumers right now who have been in the system and who are now out of the system. But we haven't been able to do that. But anyway, thank you. Any comments? Okay. I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 771, and I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 771.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 771.
Senator Cruz has moved the -1 amendments to 771. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Madam Chair.
Seeing none.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 771 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 771 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Senator Morissette.
I will reluctantly support this bill. It's my bill, but I reluctantly support it going to Ways and Means. This is very close to the mental health parity. This is, we're talking about the same kind of thing. And I will work with the President's office. I will try again, and I will talk to the committee and co-chair Ways and Means to see if we can't get this moved back to the floor where it should be. And Mr. Nickel is going to write a letter explaining his situation, that there is no fiscal impact, and we'll go from there. But I will vote to send it to Ways and Means, temporarily, hopefully.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I guess, and I understand Senator Morissette's perspective on this, but if Bob's saying he's got a position within the agency, I mean, there's still an impact because it is going to take FTE, and I think it's appropriate that Ways and Means takes a look at it. If it can be handled within his budget, as he says it can, then I don't see where they're going to have a problem just moving it on. We will still have the ability to have the discussion on the floor, but in these budget times, I think it's appropriate for Ways and Means to be able to look at these things to make sure that the impact is minimal.
All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Monsanto?
Aye. Motion carried to Ways and Means. Okay, I close the public work session on Senate Bill 771, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. Okay, Ellen Penny was actually next. Is she here?
Yes.
This is a continuation of our discussion from last week. Okay, and again, 2 minutes. That's all you get.
For the record, my name is Ellen Finney. I'm staff to the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We strongly support this bill. The target population of this bill makes less than $80 a month. I have attached in my testimony a copy of the letter from the Joint Interim Committee on Human Services to the legislative leadership recommending adoption of the elimination of the $6 premium. I have attached to my testimony enrollment numbers for Oregon Health Plan Standard, which shows by income level the decline in enrollment among folks who are the target of this legislation, people earning less than 10% of the federal poverty level. I think it's important to note that we as an organization are a sponsor of premiums so that we can legally collect and distribute and contribute premiums to William Earhart, the premium collection agency, on behalf of these clients. Every time we send them a check for the $6 client, more than half of it comes out to pay for William Earhart services alone. Despite the fact that premium sponsors are supporting the $6 premium, clients are getting notices 3 days before their final premium is due that say they have been disenrolled from the program, creating mass confusion for folks enrolled in Standard. There are those who will say that this bill should be opposed because it does not go far enough. In fact, our coalition has always supported the elimination of premiums for all folks below the poverty level. We think it doesn't work to ensure access. However, if we believed as a state that we should do nothing, if we can't do everything, we wouldn't even have the Oregon Health Plan. So it seems that the target of the expenditure of public resources should be on people who are the most economically and medically vulnerable. And this bill starts getting us to that place. Thank you for your consideration and for your leadership.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Penny. Okay. Is Scott Manchester here? Michael Garland? No? Okay. Angela Kimbo and Joyce Soros. Is Joy here? No? Okay. Ellen Lowe? Nope.
You're doing good.
Yeah. Doug Riggs? Nope. Good. We're whipping through this great. Sorry about that. Lori Freeman? All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And what I just want to point out is that as community mental health programs, our mission, if you will, is to serve those who are in need of mental health and addiction services who have nowhere else to turn. And in order to understand this bill and why we strongly support it, it's really important to understand the differences between OHP Plus and OHP Standard. And a lot of times, people think that those with serious mental illnesses, for example, only fall into the Oregon Health Plan Plus category, or that they can easily become eligible. And what I want to point out to you is this. The process by which people become eligible for disability, or SSI, is extremely time-consuming. It's a bureaucratic mess. And it takes often the advocacy of people who know what they're doing, and the individual who's struck with mental illness is often not the person who's able to take that on. And as a result, Oregon Health Plan Standard has played an incredibly important part in actually capturing those who've just become ill or who have become unstable and were previously, for example, insured, in capturing those individuals until such time that they can actually be put on OHP Plus. But during the time that people are on OHP Standard, the very nature of serious mental illness has caused them to often be disproportionately representing as those folks who end up not paying a premium and being disenrolled from Oregon Health Plan Standard. In fact, I just want to give a very quick example. There's a young woman, 25 years old, with a serious mental illness, bipolar disorder, with paranoid features to it. And just last year, she became unstable despite having a regimen of medications. They stopped working for her as well as they had in the past. She scraped together money, and she bought a plane ticket. She bought a plane ticket to London so that she could marry Prince William. Luckily, the security guards at Heathrow were very kind, put her up in a hotel, found out who her parents were, and got her back home. But in the meantime, she failed to pay that premium, and she was disenrolled from OHP Standard. This is the kind of person that is becoming disenrolled. This is the kind of person who is disproportionately hurt by this policy. We understand the intent, but it has harmed the very population we seek to serve. And because of that, we ask that you implement this legislation and help us help the most vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center, which is a nonprofit statewide law office. I've worked for the Oregon Law Center or for legal aid programs in Oregon since 1983, and therefore I've seen a lot of the clients who are impacted by these premium policies. One thing that's for sure is that even though someone may not be receiving SSI, as the previous speaker just stated, it doesn't mean they're not disabled. And I've represented many, many people who are disabled, who need medical care, but not they're not disabled enough to qualify for SSI. And so they very much have to rely on OHP standard. At the same time, most of them have no income or very little income, and what they do have, they usually have to spend to put a roof over their head or food in their mouth. So I'm here in support of Senate Bill 924 because I've seen the impact of the premium policy, and while I agree it doesn't go far enough, at least it targets the people who are the most vulnerable, the most poor in our state, and I just don't think we can continue to tolerate requiring premiums of people with less than $80 per month. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion? Okay. Jenny Hamilton, Barney Spate, last two that have been that are on the list here. Jenny, do you want to go first?
Sure.
Okay.
Have packets coming to you, but thank you for listening. And I'm Jenny Hamilton, for the record, with Oregon Primary Care Association, and I represent over 100 outreach workers that work every day enrolling families in the Oregon Health Plan. And in your packet, I'd like to point out, as a result of OHP Plus and Standard being split in February 03, several notices were sent to clients that created a lot of confusion and I think drop-off of people disenrolling just because of all of the mixed messages and information that they were getting. And so this, they're OMAP notices, and it's in the back of your packet. And I think it's important to know that any decisions that are made by you all then are affected through administration and changes that impact clients through various notices and changes, and it's a lot for them to keep up with. And so I'm in support of Senate Bill 824. The most vulnerable people are at, you know, $80 or less a month, and the majority of them have very debilitating illnesses, mental health issues, and you can see from the front page of my testimony that, you know, in just 2 years we've dropped over 22,000 people from the 0 to 10% level, and over 80% of people that file personal bankruptcy, it's because of inability to pay health insurance or, I mean, health care costs, although the 0 to 10%, they probably would not even be filing because they're showing up uninsured and causing all of our premiums to go up. So I just urge you to support reducing these premiums. I know that it's been recommended by the Medicaid Advisory Committee and other groups, and I just hope that you will pass it out of committee and eliminate the premiums. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Anderson, for the record, Barney Spade, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Program, Department of Human Services. Senate Bill 824 is similar to recommendations proposed by the Department to the Emergency Board in late 2004 and in January 2005. And the Emergency Board at that point deferred action on the proposal and handed off, if you will, to the current legislative session. So we're very familiar with the policy perspective because we suggested this similarly last year. I would like to point out two caveats regarding the bill, however. There is a fiscal impact in that I think everyone realizes the standard program is currently funded exclusively by taxes levied on various provider organizations and client premiums. The elimination of the $6 premium would mean a loss of, we're estimating, about $1.4 million in premium revenue, or about $3.6 million total funds. The way we would manage that if this bill were to become law would be, because the standard program is currently closed, would be to take the enrollment of the standard population down an additional 300 to 350 persons, we're estimating around 325, to offset that loss of premium revenue. The second caveat, Madam Chair, that I'd point out is that our recommendation was that the premiums be waived for persons under 10%. The bill, as drafted, exempts persons under 11%. And while this change is relatively minor in terms of the number of people, it does have some significant systems impact as far as how our Medicaid managed information system would have to be programmed. It would cause additional work. So if the bill, the committee wishes to move forward, I'd suggest that it read 10% or under for those purposes. It could be implemented more quickly. To conclude, the department supports the policy that's embedded in Senate Bill 824, but notes the fiscal and operational issues that I just pointed out for your consideration.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess... you know, the question here is we do this and then kick a bunch of folks off. I guess, Barney, I was wondering as I read the bill if it would make more sense or if you would support giving you the ability to, rather than requiring that you do, drop the premiums. Because the way it is now, it says you're going to drop premiums. That's it. But then you run into impacts of the people that you will have to eliminate to pick up other people. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily good. So I was wondering just if we gave you the ability to, so when things were getting better, so that you could do that without necessarily having to kick people off as revenue moved over time.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, let me respond in this way. I don't believe the way we would administer this, we would technically kick people off. There are a number of people every month in the standard population who are recertified for eligibility. It's not 1/12 of the population every month, but and a number of those people, through their changed circumstances, do not regain eligibility. And so it would be, and we are in a process now of actually, we use the term glide down, of bringing the enrollment in the standard population down to a sustainable level of between, I think it's 24,000, 25,000 clients in the 2005-2007 biennium based upon our projections of what the revenue would be. And so we wouldn't be eliminating people per se, but we would be taking the projections of the sustainable biennial number down to a number that's lower than it would be otherwise. That's one response. To the issue of may versus shall, I think this is an issue that evokes a great deal of reactions on both sides of the issues. And I believe that personally, and I haven't talked to Mr. Weeks or anybody else, I think personally we would rather have the clear support of the legislature on a policy front to say yes or no on this, as opposed to being put back into you may do it if you see things working out right.
Has there been any tracking of people who have lost their OHP due to probably premiums? I mean, have we any ability to track that? And have they actually, you know, my gut tells me that people who go off because they can't pay the $6 or $3 are going to end up into the system at a much higher cost due to hospitalization. But is there a way to track? Or
I believe, Chairman Sanderson, I believe there has been a study or maybe two studies, and there may be somebody in the room that's more up to date on this in detail, but there have been studies looking at what happened to persons who lost OHP standard coverage, not exclusively related to premium, but for a number of reasons as the standard enrollment has moved from, I think, a high of 80-some thousand in February of 2003, net down to now the 30,000. And there was material made available to the committee that indicates that a number of those people had reported in this follow-up study that the availability of resources was, it was hard for them to continue to keep coverage, and that they delayed, deferred, or did not seek medical care otherwise because they had no coverage. I'm not an expert on that, but we can make that, I think, through the Office of Health Policy and Research, we can make those studies available to you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Moore.
Thank you. How much money is raised through other organizations or individuals paying premiums? I know at one time we heard about it was a contracting group that charged $3 for every $6 they raised, I believe, and did help pay the premiums. But are organizations donating money for that?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morissette, there are a number of organizations by the nature of their organizational makeup are permitted to pay premiums on behalf of persons who would otherwise lose eligibility for not paying the premiums, and those are being paid on a monthly basis. And there are a number of organizations that, if you will, are working with these organizations. Ms. Penny testified earlier about her organization. I believe there are a number of others. There are some county governments that are paying premiums for persons that are enrolled in the program that live in their counties. I don't have the numbers at hand, but I can get you those. The intent of, as I understand it, of the premium payment is to make certain that nobody loses coverage for non-payment of premium, and therefore there's always a grace period that comes up, as was testified earlier. Prior to losing coverage, the premiums are paid by a third party that's supported by a number of community organizations.
Well, may I follow up? Mm-hmm. I think that's a great program, and I think I would agree with Senator Cruz's comments of May, because that would give you the flexibility to keep the money coming in from those organizations who are willing to do that, and give you the flexibility of deciding how to deal with the people who can't afford to pay the premium. So I think that's a good option. The cost of dropping the programs is over $1 million. I mean, dropping the premiums, it would be $1 million hit.
We're estimating about a $1.4 million in loss of premium revenue,
yeah,
which equates to a little over 300 persons.
Yeah, well,
I think that, and again, I'll take this under advisement and get back to you, Chairman Sanderson and Senator Morissette. I think that we probably need to have a clearer policy relative to the equal treatment of clients of some paying premium, some being their premium being waived for non-payment. I'm not certain we have that flexibility under either state or federal law, but I can get you information on that.
Thank you.
I would like to committee move this bill on Wednesday with the 10% amendment, and let's just I remember seeing, and I don't remember what, maybe it was in Ways and Means sub, regarding the impact of those that lost their premium. I've seen a graph or something where the costs really are much, much higher, and it's the hospitals that are taking the hit because they're not, they're not either getting their medication or they're waiting till they're really sick and then they're being hospitalized. So
we'll find that information, Madam Chair, for your use and for the record.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
That's it, right? Okay. I hear this on Wednesday. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 885 and like to, 824, and I would like to open a public hearing on 855. Yes, and Mr. Bacobian, please describe the bill.
Thank you, Senator. And what we have with the bill is the -1 amendments that I just received, so I'm going to have to defer to the proponents and drafters of these amendments to explain them. And also, I did not have time to get any fiscal information on the amendments, so we'll again defer to Mr. Weeks and Mr. Mason to address that matter. Basically, the bill does address, designates a tribal council of a federally recognized tribe, manage authority for parent and children health services at the local public health, at the Public Health Authority. And again, I'm going to let them describe the amendments. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Okay, Michael Mason and Gary Weeks.
Chair Miles Anderson, members of the Health Policy Committee, thank you for convening the work group on Senate Bill 855. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I lobby for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. The work group held a very helpful discussion of how to achieve the tribe's goals that gave rise to this bill. Director Weeks proposed a thoughtful compromise, which you have in front of you as the -1 amendments. The compromise provides for an equitable share of federal dollars. It doesn't change the amount of money that's involved here, so I don't believe there's any fiscal at all impact at all. But it does provide for some of those dollars going to tribes for this critical area of maternal child health. Puts the money where it can be best used, where the care is already being provided by the tribal clinics. It's in the cooperative spirit of the government-to-government relationship, codified by Senate Bill 770, and it has the full support of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. We urge your adoption of the -1 amendments and do pass recommendation, and thank you for your prompt consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of the amendments that Michael just described to you. We did have, I think, a very thoughtful and candid discussion about the original bill and its purpose, and that occurred in my offices with the representatives from the Council of Public Health Officials and also with Michael and other members of the tribes. And we really tried to set about understanding what the tribes had wanted, and the specific purpose for the tribes to bring this bill forward was to gain access for tribal children and their parents access to the Title V money, children and child maternal health dollars. Tribal children are calculated in the calculation of the number of kids that is the basis for us receiving Title V money for this particular program. And yet the dollars have always flowed through local public health offices, local county offices. And the tribe, in this case, there is one tribe specifically, and that is Warm Springs, although the bill speaks to other tribes being eligible at some point in the future, wanted to be able to have a share of the Title V dollars available to the tribe, so the tribe itself could provide for children, their member children. And as we talked about this, we found agreement to that end on the part of both the local county health officials and the tribe. You'll see a letter from Linda Fleming. Linda had hoped to be here with Michael and I to testify. She's ill today and asked me to provide the committee with this letter of support reflecting the position of the local county health officials. So we think we have a very good compromise, one that gets meets the ends of the tribe itself and one that is satisfactory to local county health officials, and we would urge your acceptance of the amendment.
Thank you. Discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weeks, I just want to make sure I understand the purpose of this for Warm Springs in particular, but what would be the impact, or what would be the options of, let's say, Cow Creek, who does have a clinic, and in a county that already has a public health authority? Would this allow them to access a portion of the Title V dollars relative to their tribal members without an adverse impact, other than obviously the kids go there instead of the public health authority? I mean, is this something that is workable in these other places as well?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it is workable. That's the way that the amendments were designed, is to allow another tribe to come in. At this point, we don't have any interest from any other tribes, but at some point in the future, certainly, you know, the Cow Creek, Grand Ronde, which actually serves two counties,
right,
and stuff, there would be an option for them to enter in and to get a per capita share based on the number of tribal children to be eligible of these dollars.
Correct. Okay. Follow up?
Yes.
Fiscal impact?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Senator Cruz, actually there isn't any, because the Title V dollars are a whole and the tribal children are counted in determining the whole. They just don't have a share going to them to manage.
The reason for the question, the SMS said indeterminate, and we wanted to make sure we could send this to the floor.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you for the question.
Great. Any further comments? All right. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 855, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 555.
855.
855.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 855.
Senator Cruz moves the amendment, First Amendment, -1 to 855. Do I hear a motion? Any discussion? Any opposition? Okay, so amended.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 855 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 855 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Chair Montana?
Aye. Motion passed, and Senator Atkinson and Senator Shields are carriers of this bill. Let's ask them to carry it. Unless someone else?
Well, no, that's fine. One of them could, but we can let them both do it.
Well, they're both. Do you have a preference, Mr. Mason?
It's hard to define a preference between those two stellar individuals.
They'll co-carry it. Okay, we close the work session on Senate Bill 855.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Madam.
I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill public hearing on 876. And Mr. Bacobian is going to bring us the sheet. Okay. Shall we call Laura Smith, Kim Scott, and Jennifer Graham Robinson first? Mr. Bacobian will describe the bill.
And briefly, the amendments you have, the dashed ones, actually replace the bill, and this requires that if the Department of Human Services increases the amount of capitation rates paid to mental health organizations that contract with DHS to provide managed care health services, that it should reflect the cost of living, i.e. that money should go directly to the providers at cost of living. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Laura Smith, here today with Dave Barrows and Associates, here today representing Trillium Family Services. They are a nonprofit provider of children's intensive mental health treatment. We are here today to talk to you about the concepts in the -1 amendments to 876, which do ensure that whenever the legislature appropriates a cost of living adjustment, that that adjustment actually make it down to those point of service providers. This has no fiscal impact. It just ensures that if and when that does happen, that it makes it to these people. With me today, I have Ken Scott with Trillium Family Services. He just stepped out of the room. He will be here shortly. But I'm going to turn this over to George Rex. He's the executive director of Riverbend Youth Center in Oregon City.
It is.
And I'll let him start, and hopefully Kim will jump in here in just a moment.
Madam Chair, committee members, as was just said, I'm George Rex, the Executive Director of Riverbend Youth Center. However, today I am representing the Children Array of Psychiatric Programs, CHARP agencies. The CHARP members are Albertina Kerr, Christie School, Eastern Oregon Adolescent Multi-Treatment Center, Morrison Center, Riverbend Youth Center, SCAR Jasper, Southern Oregon Adolescent Study and Treatment Center, and Trillium. The CHARP member agencies serve children with very serious mental and behavior disorders and their families. We serve them in nationally accredited psychiatric residential and day treatment facilities, as well as in treatment foster care, in-home, and community settings. The acuity of need combined with stringent accreditation, state and federal requirements create significant fixed costs for these programs.
rates were established by the state in the early to mid-90s based on actual audited cost at the time. However, they have not been raised since that time, and they have not kept up with the cost of living. Our members have not received a cost of living increase in the rate of two bienniums, nor have rates been adjusted in response to three significant unfunded state and federal mandates. This has had a particular impact on the staff who provide direct services to the troubled youth and families, as our organization typically pass along the COLAs to their staff. Due to low reimbursement rates, staff in our industry are not paid well. A recent salary study of the CHARP agency or the CHARP program showed that bachelor level individuals were entering at approximately $9 to $10 per hour. In fact, many staff in our organization qualify for the new poverty level family health plan. The recent strike at Perry Center highlighted this problem for one agency, but it is in fact a statewide issue. The governor's budget proposes a 2.4% COLA for the coming biennium. The CHARP agencies strongly support the COLA. However, the change in the children's mental health system being planned in response to a budget note from the 2003 legislature will result in intensive children's mental health services being integrated into managed care providers. Providers will be contracting with mental health organizations once the children's system change initiative is implemented. Without a direct state contract, there is no clear assurance that any COLA approved by the legislation would get to the point of service. The MHOs have different contracting mechanisms and practices which could lead to circumstances in which COLAs did not support direct service delivery by providers but become used for other purposes. Senate Bill 876 addresses and fixes this problem. It requires any legislative approved cost of living adjustment to be passed directly through to treatment providers. It ensures that legislative intent to support the agencies and staff providing the immediate treatment services is fulfilled. It is in keeping with long-established precedents of state agencies passing cost of living increases directly to providers. The CHARP members urge legislation, as well as this committee, to pass Senate Bill 876. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with your permission, can I bring up Kim Scott with Trillium Family Services?
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members. Wanted to talk just a minute about
876. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Kim Scott. I'm the president of Trillium Family Services. And Trillium is comprised of Trillium Family Services of Central Oregon, Children's Farm Home in Corvallis, and in Portland, Waverly Children's Home and Perry Center for Children. And I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk about what can happen in an organization when your fixed costs are extremely high and you go for two biennia without a cost of living adjustment in the contracts. As the president at Perry Center, we did go through a strike that was a 58-day strike. We had a labor dispute, and while there were many issues, I think, that were brought forward in that labor dispute, everything from the issue of union security and probably the relationships between management and the union, a core issue that we both fundamentally agree on is that there is a national issue regarding how bachelor's level people that are charged with the duties of working with children, how they're paid, and I think that really played out at the Perry Center at a recent There was a recent compensation study done by CHARP across all of the member agencies. And we essentially pay our bachelor's level folks, and this is consistent with national information as well, about $9 to $10 an hour. In a situation where over the last few years not only did we receive cost of living adjustments in our contracts, but we also went through a time where there were significant unfunded mandates in terms of how we oversee our business with things like seclusion, restraint, evidence-based practice. All of those types of mandates were without funding. And it just happened to parallel the biennium where we did not receive cost of living adjustments. So when you have a lot of high fixed costs, the member agencies of CHARP, Trillium Family Services, really rely on cost of living adjustments to be able to provide even modest increases in our wages to our direct service staff, or any of our staff for that matter. But I do want to clearly point out that the bachelor's level folks are in that range of $9 to $10 an hour. It's a fundamental issue I think that all of us have a responsibility on working on. And while it doesn't get us to the point where we're actually paying a living wage, I think at least by the legislature ensuring the cost of living adjustments do get to the point of service, we're at least not losing any more ground than we currently are. So I would urge your support of Senate Bill 876. Thank you.
Thank you. That's the dash one amendment to 876. That's one more person on our panel, Madam Chair, and that's Jennifer Grun Robinson, and she is an employee at Trillium Family Services and wants to talk a little bit about it from an employee's perspective.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Graham Robinson. I've been working at the farm home, which is one of the is part of Trillium Family Services, for about 3 years. Two of those has been as a treatment team leader, so I've been directly managing one of the units. I started out managing the assessment and stabilization unit, and I'm currently managing the new SAPE program. That's the Oregon took over for the Oregon State Hospital adolescent program for psychiatric inpatients program. The farm home, specifically in Trillium more generally, serves a wide range of population, 5 to 17, both genders, wide range of disorders, anything from, you know, your basic ADHD all the way up to some pretty severe psychosis, bipolar kind of things like that, various IQ ranges and that kind of stuff. But the staff that work with these children are responsible for maintaining a therapeutic program for these kids so that they're able to learn the skills. All those evidence-based program things that have been implemented recently, the reduction in holds and seclusions, they are working really hard to have that be something that is part of the program and is a therapeutic model. They've done a really good job with this. The one problem that has come up is often the staff that I have that are really the most excellent staff that I manage, because they're so capable, they're very capable employees, even if they really want to be there, they're unable to stay there because they have monetary issues. They need to be able to take care of their family, and they're really unable to do that. At the farm home right now, which is really sad. Now that I, as an employee, as someone who works on the ground floor, I can understand, when you're working with these kind of kids, it's very intense, very draining. It takes a lot out of you. As a manager, it's one of my biggest struggles because I believe very strongly that having a good staff team is the most important thing for providing a stable environment for these kids to learn the skills that they need. And in talking to my staff as they funnel through the program and go on to other things, one of the biggest things for them has been in the past couple of years the fact that they have not had cost of wage increases, so they're looking to other places where they can, be getting that money that they feel has been lost to them. I also want to say, just as someone who works in this field, it's not generally about the money. People choose to be in this field because they want to, provide stable environments for kids. They want to help them out when they're being really challenged and unsure of what to do. It makes it quite a burden to have to figure out how to make the economic bit work out when you're having a hard time supporting your family. So I would just ask that you would consider this bill as something that not, it's not going to take money away from people, just something that will make sure that the money gets to the place that it's really needed at, you know, on the level of the people who are working really hard with these children and trying to make ends meet.
Thank you. Discussion. All right. We have a number of people. George Rex and Bill Wellard. George Rex. Oh, he just did it. Sorry. Bob Nickel, Bill Welland, Dave Fiskum. And if you can
make sure that he passed the click and increase that.
What a concept.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, State Administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. The department is neutral on this on the Dash One amendments. We clearly recognize the problem here. For 4 years, there have been no cost of living increases for staff. Not only in these programs, but a lot of other programs, most programs around the state. And I think you heard very clear testimony of the impact that that causes for people, particularly at the direct service level, to stay around long enough to really, you know, be there and develop the skill base that's needed. The concerns that we have, and we're still reviewing technical and policy issues here, but the concerns that we have to do with how you do this in a capitation environment and how you build into actuarial rates, something that in most practice now the mental health organizations actually would have the contracts for these services. So I know that the department very much wants to find a way to pass on the 2.4% cost of living increase, and it's really a matter at this point of us figuring out what the best mechanism to do that is. I'm told by people in the department who look at this that there's a preliminary estimate of $117,000 to do the actuarial work that it would take to get this built into the capitation rate. So that's an issue that we need to talk further about and find a way to resolve. But it is the intent of the department to find some mechanism that would allow the 2.4% cost of living increase to be passed along to the providers. So that's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members of the record, Dave Fiskum here representing the Christie School, a private facility, as some of you know, that happens to be located at Merrillhurst, offers a comprehensive array of mental health services for children, and I believe has somewhere between 70 and 80 children placed with Christie by the state, and they come from all of Oregon's 36 counties. I'll be fairly brief to indicate that we're supporting the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 876. I distributed to you a letter from Lynn Saxton, the Executive Director of the Christie School, and along the way would refer you to the fifth paragraph on the page one of that letter, which does a better job than I can do of describing the rationale for passing on these dollars, should they exist, in the budget for 2005-07 that the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature approves. Our goal is to, as an important principle here, to get those dollars out to the community to benefit the direct care staff who are doing the work and have been without an increase for some years. I should add that we have met with Gary Weeks a couple of times in the last few weeks and have appreciated his assurances that this is, in fact, the governor's priority as well, to make sure these dollars get out, if you will, to the field and to direct the COLA in the way Mr. Nickel has suggested, and we appreciate and are prepared to rely on those assurances. So with that, Madam Chair, I have some brief comments on another bill on your agenda, which has the same principle, getting money to the community where it can be used directly by direct care staff, Senate Bill 877, but I'll wait for the hearing on that, and with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Willard. I'm currently executive director of the Child Center and president of Oregon Association of Treatment Centers, a group of 16 psychiatric day treatment centers throughout the state. And for the record, I'm a little bit confused. I have not seen the Dash 1 amendments. I certainly have, as an executive director of a private day treatment program, some comments or some ideas about that. But I was here to testify today on Senate Bill 876 as it was Friday, which dealt with the family of one portion. Is that still open, or has that
not at this point in time?
Okay, then disregard my testimony, because that was addressed for the Medicaid eligible or the family of one. As an executive director of private nonprofit, I agree with all that has been said. We rely heavily on we're labor intensive. We rely heavily on the staff that we can recruit and retain. If we're to be a viable resource for the state of Oregon, and if we're to provide the services to the most intensely disturbed children with the greatest mental and emotional disorders, we have to be able to recruit and retain qualified staff. We're only as good as the product that we can provide is determined by who we hire. And as has been indicated, there's been a number of years that we've gone without a COLA, or cost of living adjustment, and back in February of 2003, the day treatment programs took a 43% reduction. Now, we've had some of that restored. We're still about 14% shy of what we were prior to that reduction, but all in told, it's very difficult to recruit and retain staff with that kind of uncertainty. And again, I urge that you support the Dash 1, and I'm certain that we can work with Gary Weeks and Bob and whoever else to work out the details.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The last three people, Jessica. What's the last name? Well, Jessica, what's your last name? Stevens. Jeff Hetherington and Angela Kimball. Go ahead, Jessica.
Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens. I work with SEIU Local 503, and we represent both the employees of the Perry Center and also the employees of the Child Center as well. And I won't reiterate, you've heard about some of the working conditions and the pay that our members are at, primarily due to the level of funding that the programs provide. I wanted to talk about this in the context of these are children that some of whom we've moved from the Oregon State Hospital to private care. And at this point, we want to make sure that those kids get the best treatment possible. If while the wages are certainly a priority, it translates directly into the ability to provide care for kids, because better wages will reduce high turnover rates. I could just, on the second page, there's some quotes from some of our members who work at the Perry Center, and one of our leaders there, Megan Kearney, had said that, importantly, staff time at the end of our evening is our time to work one-on-one with the children. We use this time to form healthy relationships that facilitate children's treatment. The amount of staff turnover absolutely impacts our children. Not long ago, when I was working with a child on our one-on-one time, the child asked me why they should bother to get to know me, since I was going to leave like the two staff before me. And I think that tells the story of what we see in these programs over and over again, where folks simply cannot afford to do the work any longer. Obviously, they're very dedicated to it, and it is an extremely challenging job. And these folks really want to do the work. But when they can't support themselves or their families, they do need to find ways to do that. I'd also like to say that one of the other benefits of reducing staff turnover, and when a program has the ability to better staff the program, that the accidents and incident rates are also reduced. And you'll see with the decreasing staff numbers, you'll find an increased rates in incidents and accidents on the units, which obviously creates a very dangerous environment for both the staff and the children that are being treated as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Angela?
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And as community mental health programs, we are treatment providers and join those intensive treatment providers who are up here today and recognize this. We have also worked without COLAs for the last couple of legislative sessions, and we understand that they're very real and unavoidable costs that people are incurring without the benefit of having an adjustment. There have been remarkable increases in insurance costs, in labor, in utilities, etc. And as other people have pointed out, there is the effect of not having consistency in staff when you cannot provide the kind of wages that people really need to earn a living and stay in the same kind of business in which we rely on their expertise. But at the same time, we have to recognize that as community mental health programs, we actually make up regional organizations called mental health organizations that manage risk for us. And while we understand the intent of this legislation and firmly support the ideals of trying to pay people the right wages, and in fact we would probably be the strongest supporters for larger COLAs, at the same time, we have to pose two major issues we have with this particular solution. One is mechanical. COLAs represent a fee-for-service type of mechanism for addressing an adjustment. But in the capitation world of our MHOs, we need that flexibility to manage the risk of the population we serve. And everything is rolled together in that MHO contract, and to try and tease out a particular COLA creates some logistical difficulties that are difficult for us to deal with. And secondly, on a policy level, we believe that this legislates a pricing agreement at the local level. And that's sort of antithetical to how we formulated MHOs to begin with, the vehicle, if you will, for managing risk on a regional basis. It's as though you gave us a car to drive, a minivan. And our job is to manage the number of people that we can put in that minivan, the right speed, et cetera, to serve the people that we need to serve. And by trying to create legislation that tells us how fast we must go, it may be the right speed at one point in time, but it may be too fast in another point in time, too slow in another. In other words, this legislation attempts to fix a problem in a way that's logistically difficult and in a way that, from a policy standpoint, encumbers us from doing the very flexible things that could actually be counterproductive, that could actually allow us to negotiate higher COLAs for some treatment providers. We've certainly had MHOs in the past that, when they have taken cuts in capitation, have actually shielded their providers and increased their payments. When you start to legislate the pricing agreements, you take away that flexibility that we have as your local partners to negotiate things both that benefit and that can shield our providers. So I know this sounds fuzzy and I'm perhaps not being clear enough, but the difficulty we really have is this is an imperfect solution to a difficult problem, and we would suggest that perhaps a more plausible solution is that we get our treatment providers together with our community mental health programs and with our MHOs to discuss the very real problems people are having. We need good wages. We need consistent staff. We need good quality of care. We don't deny that. We're just suggesting there's a better way.
Thank you. Mr. Hetherington.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care, one of the holders of an MHO contract under the Oregon Health Plan. I'm here to speak in opposition to the -1 amendments. Some of the reasons have already been elicited, but you have some written testimony, but I'd like to speak to a couple of key issues within that. The first reason why we would oppose this is because the entire idea of letting out a capitation contract is to allow the local community providers to make a decision about where the money should best be spent. You may have different risk populations that require allocation of resources to various groups over other groups that would not occur from area to area. So that's number one. You do have some differentials. Our risk is different in Portland than it might be, for instance, in Grants Pass, or it might be in the area of Pendleton. This legislation does not speak to geographical distribution. So if our rates went up in one area and we only had certain treatment providers in another, we would have to increase our rates directly over to that one particular area. It also does not speak to what happens if there's a capitation increase that's unrelated. It's purports to say if it's related to a cost of living adjustment. Well, what happens if the capitation premium goes down? Then do we have the ability to adjust in that direction? And the way we read this, the answer is no. And in fact, MHO capitation payments are going to go down in this next contract period. The third area that really concerns me is, and not to disagree, that cost of living adjustments are needed throughout the provider community. I think anybody who is in a capitated program, whether it's MHO or fully capitated health plans, would say those cost of living adjustments are long overdue. But why do we pick one group of providers and allow them to have legislation that says their rates go up? What are we going to do with the rest of them? Because the rest of them have just as good an argument. And the minute you start putting this kind of stuff into legislation, then you're negotiating our contracts, and you might as well go back to the old fee-for-service system. And what happens under the old fee-for-service system? Nobody gets a cost-of-living adjustment because the money's not there. And so I would say to the legislature, be careful of what you wish for, because what you're doing here is you're making promises that you're not funding in the long run. And so we would oppose this under any circumstances, because we think it advantages one group of providers over another. Given the number of providers out there, what you're doing is you're setting yourself up for a battle, in every single legislative session, which group of providers is going to come next and ask you for the same thing.
Okay. Discussion.
Chairman Sanderson, just to clarify for the record, even though I'm sitting up here with these folks, that SEIU does support the -1 amendments. I didn't say that in my testimony. Thank you. Is Jim Russell in? Jim Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. That's a mental health organization operating in this five-county region. There was a little bit of shift, at least in my mind, between what just happened and what I had planned happening when I put my name on the list. And so, actually, Angela said a little bit better than I had planned to say what I wanted to say. But you've called me up, and so I'll take just a minute to underline that again. We have a mutual interest with all of our providers in them being successful. As a mental health organization, they have to succeed for the access to be there and for the high quality of service to be there. I am one of the MHOs that 2 years ago, when our capitation rates went down 16%, we paid our hospitals more and we paid our providers more because their costs have gone up. I don't think it's wise policy for the legislature to begin setting prices, and I would echo what Mr. Hetherington said. Surely the Hospital Association would be interested in the opportunity. I'm not speaking in support of the -1 amendment.
Thank you.
I would like it left to us. I think the idea that Angela finished with, that we can craft a better solution that will really work for the provider system, is preferable. Thanks.
Thank you. The reason I like the Dash 1 amendments is this legislature, I think, has taken a very strong stance that says mental health is something that we need to deal with, and we have been neglecting it, and we need to put more emphasis on it. And I feel there's a valid statement to referring this to Ways and Means to look at getting our mental health providers up to a level where they can, where the turnover is not going to be as great as it is now. Is there any discussion, Senator Morsat?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just feel that your, I honestly believe that your service is only as good as the people they have working for you. And if you don't have adequate funding to hire and keep good people, your service as a whole is going to decline significantly. So I totally support that. Mm-hmm. Totally support that.
Senator Cruz? No question. No? All right. I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 876, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 876.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 876.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 to Senate Bill 876. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 876 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 876 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, that's the appropriate place to continue this discussion.
All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morsett?
Aye.
Chairman
Sanders? Aye. Motion passed. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 876, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 877. Public hearing on 877. Bob Nickel, Bill Willard, and Dave Fiskum can all come up together.
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. As I understand the amendments to Senate Bill 877, this would require the Department of Human Services to provide medical assistance for children with severe mental illness who are at risk of hospitalization or placement in an alternative institutional setting. And if I'm speaking to the correct amendments, I think I'm on the right track here. The concerns that we have, we're again neutral on this bill, but we do want to testify for information that this is a concept that my office has been supportive of for some time. However, the department has attempted on three different occasions to get the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to approve a waiver amendment that's limited to children with mental health disabilities, and each time we've clearly been told that that is not something they're willing to approve unless it's a much broader group of children with disabilities. Therefore, our analysis would suggest that CMS is unlikely to approve a narrowly constructed waiver request as is provided for in the Dash 1 amendments. The waiver requests, even if we made one, require about at least 9 months. This bill does not cap the number of children that would qualify, but we've done estimates that suggest that it would involve about 4,609 children, and the monthly mental health treatment cost with medication we're estimating at $4,461. With the additional medical, dental, alcohol, and drug capitation costs, the full program implemented in 07-09 would be a general fund cost of $133,578,557. And the 05-07 cost, which would assume that it would take these 9 months for a waiver to be approved, if it was approved, the cost for 875 children would be in general fund funds, about $35 million, almost $36 million. So we need to provide the information on the record so that the committee has our perspective on how we've tried to do this before, the analysis that we've done about the costs that would be involved. I have to say, this would be a great thing if the state could choose to find the funding to do it, but as you can tell, this is not a small amount of money that's involved here. There would also be some administrative costs, and I don't have the final figures on those, but they look like they are in the range of about $1.9 million general fund for the 05-07 budget and about $2.5 million general fund for the 07-09. And I'm told that the senior budget analyst thinks that this would require 45 and a half full-time equivalent positions to do the necessary work administratively. So that's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have some.
The reason, actually, this was my bill and a previous bill that got amended into this bill, and I know there's complications with this, but I want to tell you the story of why this was brought forward. I was door knocking in the campaign, and a family came to me, and they had a severely mentally disabled child, and they said the only way that they could get proper services was to give up their rights as parents and to turn them over to the state. And this was so heart-wrenching for them. How can you give up your parental rights to your own child just so that they can get the proper services that they need? And so that's why I brought this bill forward, because I feel we need to have a discussion, because what a tragedy for families when already they have a child that is mentally disabled, and then to have to give up the parental rights when they actually did want to care for their child. They wanted to keep the child in their home, but they couldn't. They had to do what the state system set up. So that's why I want to start the conversation with this, and we know we have some issues and processes, but we just needed to bring that forward. All right. Next.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, again, Dave Fiske. I'm here representing Christie School. It's my turn to be only briefly confused, I think, because what I was prepared to do is just make a comment on the original printed form of Senate Bill 877, because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I believe there's an important principle there as well in that bill. And if, with your indulgence, I'll do that, and then I think my colleague will probably get back to the household of one issue in a moment. Senate Bill 877 in its printed form is designed to, perhaps inadequately in terms of the language, but to capture the so-called new provider revenue, quote-unquote, for children's mental health programs, because when those dollars begin to flow through, when the program begins to flow through mental health organizations, it will become subject to the managed care tax, as I understand it, passed by the 2003 legislature, which creates new money, by no means a windfall in light of testimony previously today about the hard-pressed character of children's mental health programs. When those, quote, new dollars, unquote, begin to flow, it's the Christie School's perception and others that those dollars ought somehow to be captured for children's mental health programs and not to be allowed to simply go to another laudable place where they would go under Oregon's current law. My understanding, not being a legal scholar on these technical managed care tax matters, is that in order to redirect those dollars to this purpose, you would have to have legislation to do so. My belief, Madam Chair and committee members, is that Senate Bill 877 is also a good place to start, if you will, that discussion and to make a policy judgment on that before this session is over. If there are new dollars associated with that managed care tax, once those dollars are of an unknown amount at this moment, as much as $6 million, I believe, but perhaps not that amount. If, in fact, the system change initiative doesn't begin until October, whatever the amount is, our advocacy is that a conscious decision be made about where those dollars go once they begin to arrive in state coffers. With that, Madam Chair, I'll leave that issue and move to my colleague, Mr. Willard, to my right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Willard, Executive Director of the Child Center, a psychiatric day treatment center located in Springfield, Oregon, and also the current president of the Oregon Association of Treatment Center Association, comprised of 16 psychiatric day treatment programs. I will speak, again, I understand there's a little bit of confusion. I'm with Dave. I was here to testify a little differently, but I think now I have a little better understanding. We've kind of combined the two bills, and so in terms of the first issue with the original printing of Senate Bill 877, I too want to express our support. It would assure that the funds collected from assessments imposed on managed care organizations as the result of receiving the intensive treatment dollars are in fact spent on intensive mental health treatment services for children. OMAS is in the process of making significant changes in the children's mental health system due to the budget note that was established in the 2003 legislative session. One of the primary directives of that budget note was to assure that funding intended and allocated by the legislature for children's mental health is used for that purpose. And we believe that Senate Bill 877 supports that directive and legislative intent. Secondarily, speaking to the family of one, the Medicaid issue that you just spoke to, Madam Chair, the day treatment programs were funded originally by the 1971 legislative session. And as part of that funding, in fact, for a full 32 years, we had a general fund component that allowed us to offer services to non-Medicaid eligible children so that we didn't have the families coming to us, speaking to us and saying, yes, we have a very severe need, but we're not Medicaid eligible, so we therefore can't receive those services. This, I believe, if I'm understanding the bill, would allow for children to be seen as a family of one and determined eligibility as such, and allow those children to receive the necessary treatment services that they deserve. We have lost, as I mentioned, about 43% of our funding in an earlier cut. That eliminated 164 of the families that you spoke of earlier, the families that were receiving treatment services but were not Medicaid eligible, who then were paired out of the system. And again, we think that this particular bill, this particular option, would provide families a viable treatment resource who now, as you indicated, have one of three options: do nothing, and the mental disorders generally tend to further deteriorate; secondly, enroll their children in residential facilities; or third, place them in therapeutic foster to gain their Medicaid eligibility. So we would again support Senate Bill 877 that would restore services to a segment of children with severe mental illnesses, or would, in other words, allow us to again treat children based on their psychiatric impairment and not their fiscal eligibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I have several questions, Madam Chair.
Yes.
First off, so by this, if Bill Gates had a child who had severe, who qualified under this, you're saying no. I'm saying yes. The way it reads, he's a child of one, depending upon severity. So there's no upper limit for this whatsoever. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, my understanding is that programs would be expected to first use whatever private insurance a family had, and once those were exhausted, which in this state right now, as you know, because of the lack of parity, doesn't take very long, at that point, a family that had resources could become eligible under the household of one, as long as the child was placed outside of the home setting. This wouldn't apply to the psychiatric day treatment programs.
Well,
household of one waiver would allow us to do that, and then they would be eligible for a full range of otherwise uncovered services.
Well, the bill says he can still live at home, or the child can still live at home. So, I mean, that's one question I have, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
The other, I mean, Section 2 of the bill says the Department of Human Services shall apply on or before October 31st, 2005, for the federal waivers necessary to implement Section 1 of this Act, and yet this act is implemented on January 1st of 2006, waiver or not. I'm wondering if, If acceptance of the waiver is necessary to implement this act, why does this act become implemented before the waiver is accepted? Because my sense is it may take more than 2 or 3 months for waiver approval. It generally does.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think you're doing your dating correctly there. I think there is a problem with how the language of the Dash 1 amendments read at this point.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it is important for us to take a look at this issue. And this is our first attempt to discuss it. And we would, I hope, continue this discussion. I don't plan to move this bill at this point in time, but I wish we could continue this talk maybe in the interim.
Madam Chair, if I would, I would suggest that we find a way to continue the conversation. We've had a chance to talk a little bit about it already, and I'd welcome the opportunity to do more of that.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my only quick comment is just to encourage you not to lose sight of the objective of the printed bill either as this session goes forward, because that objective is different than the household of one issue, and so I would encourage you to keep that on your to-do list as well. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'd like to close the public hearing on 877, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 882. Yes, please give a brief explanation, Mr. Bercobian.
Thank you, Chair. And we do have, with your packet, the Dash 1 amendments, which replaces the bill. And this does have substantive referral to Ways and Means. Basically, it requires the Employment Department to set up, in consultation with healthcare industry, to develop needs assessments of healthcare professionals, do this periodically, and that the assessments are to be used by higher education, Oregon Health Sciences University, and others to kind of basically drive the direction of their educational programs. Since we just received these amendments, have no information whatsoever on the fiscal impact of these particular amendments. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Joe Bell, Molly Moore, Graham Stater? Slater. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 882 in support today. For the record, I'm Jill Bell, and I'm Director of Legislative Support Services for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And appearing with me today are Molly Moore, she's Director of the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative, and Graham Slater, who is Administrator of the Employment Department's Workforce and Employment Research Section. Ms. Moore and I have testified before you at your hearing on February 25th at the Mount Hood Community College Bruning Center about the issues around healthcare workforce, and so we won't go into that background today. But I do want to focus on why we've introduced Senate Bill 882. One of the needs that 882 is trying to address is that there is no defined data source for determining the most critical healthcare workforce shortage professions right now. And while post-secondary institutions are required to do needs assessments as part of new program approval, there is no defined process or source for the information. And in addition, the needs assessments are generally focused on the service area of the institution, not on the whole statewide need. Industry involvement does drive to some degree the needs, the program development in local areas, because industry does have partnerships and that with the local providers. But there is no industry involvement on a statewide basis, and we think that that is really critical to make sure that we get the appropriate data. Beyond development of the data that is needed to provide these accurate assessments, the current program approval process only responds to the individual proposals that are of an educational institution as they are submitted and does not really look at the state as a whole. And there's the result of this piece-by-piece approval creates real pockets of need in the healthcare workforce around the state. One of the unique aspects of developing healthcare programs is the fact that they cost more than the general development of other programs. That's largely due to the fact that there are special training facilities that are frequently needed, special equipment for patient care, and also there's a need frequently for additional instructors to meet the required student and faculty ratios. And also part of that student-faculty issue, racial issue, is the fact that the healthcare education programs also require clinical experience, and so that requires not only the faculty but support staff to help manage that and monitor those students. These cost factors make it impossible for many of the educational institutions around the state, particularly some of our community colleges in the rural areas, to offer a lot of the professional programs that are needed today. The number of students that are necessary to make it resource smart to develop a program are just not there. A good example that I use a lot is when we're talking about Blue Mountain Community College in Pendleton. While there probably is a need there, in fact, there's a need all over the state for radiology technologists, they will never be able to provide a program based on their own enrollment because there are just not enough bodies there to support the cost of developing the program. So we really feel like it's important that when these programs are being approved, the educational institutions are looking, or the state board is looking at what might be available and what can be shared around the state. And at the same time that some programs are not available, there are other programs that are being duplicated around the state, and that also is a resource drain and a resource cost to not only the educational institutions but the healthcare industry, because many of the local partnerships are providing support for development of these programs in their own area without really knowing what is going on. And we really feel that both education and healthcare industry and supporting these workforce programs would be able to stretch our dollars more if we could look at things from a statewide basis. One of the recommendations from the Applications and Content Subcommittee of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council committee that they had on House Bill 2577, which was passed last session, thank you very much, was the need to focus our efforts on behalf of the students of Oregon. And two particular pieces were that they focused on for that. One of those was to provide an access around the state to an array of the healthcare professions that are actually looking for workforce. And the other one was to conserve the individual resources of the students as well as the resources of both education and healthcare sectors by making the programs transferable around the state. One of the stories that you hear frequently, and I think the nursing community is actually addressing this, but one of the stories you hear frequently is that in order to prepare themselves to apply for a variety of the nursing programs around the state, students are taking sometimes between 4 and 8 additional programs just because the prerequisites are not transferable from one institution to another, and that seems to us to be a terrible waste of the resources, not only of the individual student, but of the system, because when you have a shortage of spaces in anatomy and physiology, and part of that is because you have somebody taking the course 3 times at 3 different locations in order to meet prerequisite needs that they might have in the future, it seems like an extreme waste of our efforts. I'll turn it over now to Molly to address the specific intent of what our bill will do, and then after she has presented that, Graham will talk about the healthcare needs assessments from the Employment Department perspective.
Thank you, Jill. Madam Chair, member of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Molly Moore, and I'm the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative Coordinator. And Joe did a great job of setting the stage for the barriers and why we need this bill, and I'd like to go over our intent. I'd first like to recommend, though, that the subsequent referral of this bill over the Ways and Means is unnecessary because of the lack of fiscal impact. And also, we do have 2 changes. That we would like to make on this bill that I'll go through as well, and we'd like to make those changes as it goes over to the House. In Section 1.1, it directs the Employment Department to work with healthcare industry employers to perform state and regional needs assessments. Currently, the Employment Department does perform healthcare workforce projection data every 2 years. However, this bill would direct the Oregon Employment Department to work with healthcare industry to further supplement the data. The change in that section that we are recommending is to add educational institutions, or excuse me, post-secondary, post-secondary educational institutions to work in conjunction with healthcare industry and employment department. In Section 1-2, the bill directs the state boards of education to utilize this data to identify and direct the development of statewide healthcare education programs by community colleges, state universities, and OHSU. The second change we're recommending is that any additional data points may be used to supplement these assessments where applicable, additional industry data and what have you. And then thirdly, in Section 1-3, all new healthcare education programs must assure statewide access, transferability, course articulation, and common student learning outcomes between and among state-funded educational institutions. So we're not also advocating for how this should be done, just that this is what we should be looking at going forward. The overall goal for Senate Bill 882 is to expedite the training of the healthcare workforce and thus reducing the cost of healthcare overall. Through this bill, we hope to promote the development of healthcare education programs that distributes programs statewide when and where workforce needs are demanded. This data will also help us to better understand where the resources are most needed and assist us all in determining where we should invest our dollars to make the most impact. It also standardizes the assessment data for statewide use and gives industry a voice in this data, which is very important. Currently, any potential program can use any data sources in determining the needs for a program. Again, this goes back to the whole standardization of that data issue, that so we all can agree on what the standard data and tool is. The bill would also require the state boards to utilize this standard data set. It will also advance the development of healthcare education programs in aggregate around the state. As Joe mentioned earlier, for example, if there is a need for 2 radiology technicians in Ontario, 3 in Klamath Falls, and 15 in the Portland metro area, rather than building 3 programs, we can build 1 program that is accessible statewide for all people. This would help to keep our Oregonians in their communities, particularly in rural areas, and avoids any duplication of programs and thus resources. Additionally, this bill helps to support the development of healthcare education programs that utilize shared curriculum, which will expedite the students through the system and will make the most efficient use of students' time and resources. And just overall, this bill helps us to reach a goal providing the right number of healthcare workforce at the right place with the right education at the right time. It aligns with the governor's overall goal of linking education and workforce, and it ensures that our workforce has continued access to training opportunities and living wage jobs in their communities. Thank you very much. I'll turn it over to Graham.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Slater, Administrator of the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. My comments will be fairly brief. Quality information and informed choices is the key phrase for our division. And in the context of this bill, particularly the first paragraph, it's our job to provide the very best information we can so that the industry folks, the education, the policymakers, they all make the best possible decisions about the need for healthcare training so that we have enough healthcare workers to meet the needs of Oregonians down the road. As you can see from my handout, there's a couple graphs on the front page. Healthcare industry and occupations will grow rapidly in the next 10 years. That's probably no surprise to any of you. And in addition to that, we estimate about 25,000 openings purely because of vacancies created by retirements or other reasons why people leave the occupations. So it's not just that it's growing, it's that there will be many openings, as there will in a lot of occupations, due to the number of us that are approaching retirement ages. The Employment Department, as Molly mentioned, we already produced the 10-year projections by industry and occupation, so this is, to a large extent, work that we already do. We already do that for Oregon statewide and for each of the 15 workforce regions, and we've done that for many years. In addition, we collect information on the supply of workers that's coming out of the different educational institutions, both private and public sector, and we make estimates on a variety of other types of sources of workers, for example, in migration. The needs assessments that are envisioned in Senate Bill 882 would bring together all of the information that we currently put together, plus we would gather information from elsewhere. And a good example, some discussions in just the last few weeks, the Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems will be doing a vacancy survey of hospitals and other providers, and we would incorporate some of their information into these needs assessments, so we're not just looking at the demand for workers in the next 10 years, but the current vacancies that exist today. And that's been one of the weaknesses of our data over the past. As far as the fiscal impact that Molly mentioned, I do just want to let you know that for three reasons, we believe there's no fiscal impact for the Employment Department. One is that our mission is to support business, and this clearly is an idea and a concept that's coming from the healthcare industry itself. Secondly, by federal statute, we have a number of key customers, and among those key customers are private sector businesses, educational establishments, and elected officials. And so, again, the work that's being asked of us here would benefit all three of those key customer groups. And finally, in federal and state statute, we are required and responsible to do what's called occupational demand and supply analyses, which is exactly what this is. How many jobs will we need to fill? How many workers are there out there to fill them? So this is very much in keeping with the kind of thing we already do. Putting it together in these needs assessments, we would consider part of our regular business, and that's why we believe that there's, for us, there's no fiscal impact, and we filed documents to that effect. During the past few weeks, we have discussed the bill with the representatives of the healthcare industry and the governor's office. We've had several meetings. And while our department is neutral on the bill itself, we are very willing and eager to provide the information that these folks tell us they need. So we're fine with the bill.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I would like to just address the amendments, if I may. The amendments came out, as you might know, this morning, and since that time we've had discussions with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, the Oregon Community College Association, and some of the higher ed institutions. And in addition to the two amendments that Molly had mentioned, we had originally wanted to provide on the House side, there are a couple of issues that they would like us to address before we move the bill forward, and we think we can do that very quickly if that meets with your approval. The first one is that in line on the amendment, in line 12, the word direct has some specific meanings other than what we're thinking. Our idea of directing is that we would like the State Board of Education, the State Board of Higher Education, not to be proactively telling institutions what programs they must provide, but to work with the program approval process and to sort of direct that when there's a statewide need. And I'm not sure that this language may in fact say that the state boards need to actually go out there and direct institutions as to what programs they provide.
What I've decided to do with this bill is carry it over till next Monday. So I would like you to draft the amendments as you see fit.
Okay.
But I do need to call Julie Suhanik up, and we will continue this conversation. Next Monday.
Madam Chair, Molly and I are both out of town next Monday, but we can maybe...
But you can have the amendments ready. I think we have enough information because I would like to work it, if possible, on Monday. But I do want to hear from the community colleges.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting tonight...
Go ahead.
The 11th?
Yes. Oh, thank you. I think this is a great bill for a variety of reasons, because there's a lot of uncoordination among institutions and training centers and so on, particularly in the healthcare industry. We've got a problem, so I think this is...
I agree. I support this bill 100%, and I want to move it, but I'd like to have it in good form, and so if we have the amendments, as long as you're able to take a look at those amendments in the community colleges. Go ahead.
Thank you,
Julie.
Chair. My name is Julie Suhanik. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians. And while we support the overall notion of the bill, we do have some concerns in the draft bill and in the Nash 1 amendments that would not allow us to support the bill at this time. We do believe that it is needed for us to find the data information where we're collecting the same information so that we're identifying those high demand areas and making sure that our training provides the jobs and meets the industry standards here in the state. But we do have several concerns with the way the bill is drafted. Currently, colleges do already use the assessments produced by the Department of Education, so we are using those in terms of how we develop programs to meet our local needs. We're also concerned that in the language in Section 1-2, subsection 2, is that the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education cannot direct the community colleges because they are 17 independent locally community colleges, and they've worked with their communities to provide the programs that would meet those needs and those jobs in those areas. We're also concerned about the statewide implementation. While we do think it's a good idea, we are concerned that right now most of the programs are provided at the regional level, and that would cause a reengineering of those programs. And the idea of having one or two colleges offer the program and have to have people tap in with distance education would not only be an increase in resources in terms of funding, because distance education is expensive, but that it would not necessarily allow another college that maybe at some distance to provide that program to meet their local needs as well. We are concerned about a fiscal impact to our community colleges, specifically with subsection 3, where it refers to the transferability and common outcome language. We're very supportive of this type of policy. We're currently working with Senator Schrader on Senate Bill 342 in partnership with the Oregon University System to develop a process for us to look at common outcomes with all of our colleges and to ease the barriers that students face when they transfer, because we believe that that's a drain on state resources as well as student resources. However, the way the bill is worded with shall ensure sounds like it would mandate that for our students, and we are moving in that process, but we are by no means there. It's taken us, for example, several years just to get to the point where we are with nursing. Currently, we're working with our partners on anatomy and physiology to make sure that those have common course outcomes. So we're doing this piece by piece and working together. It's a long process, and that takes funding and travel time and staff. And as you all know, with our budget situation, that we don't have a lot of extra dollars around.
Okay. Julie, I need to move to the next bill real quick. And what I'd like you to do is get your concerns in writing and have the governor's office and Joe Bell work on that.
All right.
And hopefully the amendments will be to your liking.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right. I'd like to close the Senate bill, the public hearing. Yeah, we'll carry this over and to... Oh, no, I want to open it up right now. I want to close Senate Bill 882, and I want to open Senate Bill 1016 real quick. We'll start, but we may have to carry it over. I don't have the sheet.
Are nurses okay with this?
Yeah.
With they're willing to pay it?
Well,
nurses.
We'll find out. That's right. Yeah, because I don't know. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I am on staff with the Oregon Nurses Association, but today I'm speaking in the capacity of one of the member organizations, nursing organizations, that has been working on the solutions to Oregon's nursing shortage for a number of years. With me at the table is Joan Bouchard, Executive Director of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Just quickly for the record, and you have received an informational hearing several weeks ago in Gresham, I believe, about the nursing shortage and what the nursing community is doing to solve that shortage. The Oregon Nurse Leadership Council, at whose request this bill was introduced, is composed of the Oregon State Board of Nursing, the nurse executives, the community college nursing programs, the deans and directors of baccalaureate programs, and the Oregon Nurses Association. So this is a very broad-based coalition that's requesting this bill. You have -1 amendments, so I'll very quickly speak to those amendments and just let you know what we are trying to accomplish. For a number of years, we have been implementing our solution or plan to address the Oregon nursing shortage, and we have created the Oregon Center for Nursing, which is a 501c3 organization. That organization has functioned for the last 4 years on grant funding and program funding for specific projects. But in order for us to accomplish the work that is outlined in the activities in the -1 amendments on lines 8, 9, 10, 11 and 12, it needs a stable source of funding over time. And the nursing community has come together with a request before you today to impose fees on ourselves. So I would underscore that this is the nursing community's intent to impose fees on itself to address the nursing shortage and the activities listed in the Dash 1 amendments. The Oregon State Board of Nursing, being the state entity that collects our license fees, was the vehicle sought for the collection of this surcharge or license fee surcharge, which in the bill before you is intended to be $20 per RN and LPN license every 2 years, because our licenses are renewed every 2 years. This should provide a consistent source of funding, stable source of funding over time for the Oregon Center, and allow us to accomplish the work that we need to do to ensure an adequate nursing supply in the future. Mm-hmm. So with that, I will stop my comments, turn it over to Joan Bouchard.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joan Bouchard, and I am the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. And I'm here just to, for the record, to say that the Oregon State Board of Nursing is a member of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council, and we are on record to support this bill.
Thank you. And Dewey.
Again, for the record, my name is Julie Sahonik, and I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. And our concern was that we were not in the bill, but in talking with representatives from the Oregon Nursing Association, the amendments would take care of that. So we are in support of the bill.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion? This is a good bill. Yes? Senator Cruz.
Well, you know.
I'm not prejudiced.
No, you're not. Not at all. And I like this. My standard rule of thumb on increasing the fees inside an organization basically has been that I hear that the actual membership is supportive of the fee increase. Do we have that? Have you polled nurses on this?
I'll take a stab at answering that, Chair Mons Anderson and Senator Cruz. We have had discussions across the nursing community for the last year about this fee, and my organization within that group has the largest membership, so conceivably I will face the largest criticism, and we do support this bill.
And if we remember Senate Bill 800, it sort of had the same idea that we passed before, so we know that there's support out there. It's just that, you know, when you don't have money to pursue these areas, we need, this is really going to help us really make some improvements. Any other further discussion? I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1016, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1016.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1016.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1016. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1016 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 1016 as amended to Ways and Means with a D-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Montanison?
Aye. Motion carries, and I close the work session of Senate Bill 1016, and committee's adjourned.